Welcome to Create Tomorrow, the WJSN podcast. I'm your host, Bethan Ryder, and in this episode, we preview Singapore Design Week, which runs from the 21st of September until the 1st of October. Tune in to hear from Dawn Lim, Executive Director of Singapore Design Council. She tells us about this festival of creativity, shares the highlights, and explains how Singapore is a future-focused city-state built on seamless design systems. We dive into the theme Better by Design and talk about how the event is focusing on the future of sustainability, tech and care for our society, topics we are constantly exploring at WJSN. Then we meet the duo behind Leka Architects, Onkir Shing and Dr. Joshua Komaroff, who are curating a project for the event called Field, which is inspired by a sports field and promotes the concept of inclusivity through play. Shing and Josh of Leka are pioneers in the field of inclusive design, and they won Singapore's annual President's Design Award this year for their book Hack Care, Tips and Tricks for a Dementia-Friendly Home. Hi, Dawn. Thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Bethan. It's wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me.
So this year's theme, I'd like to kick off with that really, Better by Design. What's the thinking behind the title of this year's festival?
Design that comes from a strong sense of creative purpose, and it's crafted to deliver a positive impact. And it also exemplifies really what Singapore Design stands for, which is the desire to always look for ways to make lives better using design. And I'm a firm believer that good design is good business, good design is good government, and good design makes lives better. And so all of this is encapsulated in this year's theme of Better by Design.
And I can see that through the program, there's a really clear emphasis on a lot of the things that we talk about actually at WJSN are starting to embrace even more, which are things like inclusive design and also care culture I see running through the festival program. Could you talk a little bit about some of the highlights that you're sort of excited about?
During the break over the pandemic, we reviewed and redesigned the festival to stand across three pillars, which is design impact, design futures, and design marketplace. And these three pillars are underpinned by our focus areas on sustainability, emerging technology, and systems of care. The three key exhibitions that we have, the first one at the National Design Center is called Playground of Possibilities. And you might be wondering, like, what playground, right? And we want to show you that you can play with possibilities through the use of design when you encounter a problem and turn what could be a challenge into an opportunity. The second one is around the School of Tomorrow. And one of the other agencies that we're working with, Kinetic Singapore, is introducing critical environmental issues in a fun and immersive way through common subjects like geography, chemistry, social studies. So topics that you would see in a textbook as a student are being transformed into a playful and fun way to think about how we can redesign our impact on the environment going forward. And last but not least, of course, it's about inclusion and designing for a more inclusive society in our urban environment. And that's what Leka Architects has undertaken in their titled Field. And how do we create more inclusive space for people of different abilities to participate in society?
If you could just sort of describe some of the highlights from a visual perspective, that would be great.
So the whole purpose of the exhibitions are meant to be interactive and immersive. Over at the National Design Center with a Playground of Possibilities, we have, for example, 3D printed medical prosthetics that you could interact with, right? And it talks about how we could use design to deliver better medical outcomes. And those are opportunities, right? We also are showing electricity conducting ceramics. And so there are all these ceramic bowls and plates that you could create sounds from because it's conducting electricity, and you could come and play with that and create your own little tune at the corner as well. And if you head over to School of Tomorrow, you can take a look at how, for example, food science and how we design our future food systems, try some new types of perhaps insect snacks, right? Because that could be the protein of the future. And so it's really participatory and it's designed to be that way.
What do you think's different about your reinvigorated kind of festival?
For us in Singapore, I think if you look at Singapore's history, this nation was a nation by design. And that's something that's very much part of our DNA. Nothing that happened in Singapore was by chance. Everything was deliberately designed. And a lot of what we stand for design is actually in systems. So you don't actually walk around going, oh, that's great design. Oh, that's great design. But you experience it every day. And I'll just give you a really good example. Every international traveler, when you come to Singapore and you arrive in Changi Airport, from the moment you disembark from the plane, you get through immigration and pick up your bags and get into a taxi, it takes you no more than 30 minutes. And that's a great design passenger experience, because what they've done is taken the stress out of international travel and given you a smooth and peaceful travel experience instead. And that's really reflective of what Singapore design stands for. It's embedded in the systems around us.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Dawn.
Thank you, Bethan.
You're listening to the WGSN Create Tomorrow podcast, and we're discussing Singapore Design Week. You've just heard from Dawn Lim, Executive Director of Singapore Design Council. And next, we're going to hear from inclusive design champions, Leka Architects, who have curated a major interactive project at this year's event. So I've been looking at all your work, which is fantastic, and really exciting things you're doing in terms of inclusivity. But let's kick off, first of all, with your project for Singapore Design Week, because that's why we're here, right? So you're creating FIELD, which has a very interesting spelling, FIELD, inspired by a sports field. Can you tell me about this? Who wants to go first, Xing or Josh?
Thanks. FIELD is one of the three anchor shows for Singapore Design Week, dealing with the theme of inclusivity. All three of the shows have a kind of use or quotation of familiar or nostalgic childhood spaces. So there's a playground, there's a school, and we really like the idea of the schoolyard, in fact, the play field. It brings back very strong memories for us, but also it's where I personally learned about inclusive design in the first place. I had a wonderful, famous actually, kindergarten teacher and teaching kind of theorist and writer and educator named Vivian Paley. And she was my kindergarten teacher, and she had this iron rule at the time, which was, you can't say you can't play. That means if you're playing on the schoolyard and somebody else wants to come up and play, you can't tell them that they can't. And if they can't play, you have to change the game. And this is really was very formative. It just stuck with me for years and years and years before we were ever thinking about educational design or inclusive design. It was just a wonderful, very simple, but very deep and rich way of thinking about how to think inclusively, right? If somebody can't join, you have to play, you have to change the game. In a way, that's really the motto we're trying to think about here, as a way to get people thinking about what inclusion is and what it isn't. So our space is literally a field. We've created a kind of a sports field with outlying showcases and exhibitions and installations and experiences that pick up on the same theme. And the idea is, if we could really imagine a kind of Vivian Paley world where we have a sports field where we are constantly changing games to include everyone, and in the process also learning new games, being creative, being inventive, and finding new ways of doing things. The ampersand in FIELD is really that we want people to think about inclusion from the standpoint of more. It's not about scarce resources that we have to partition among an increasingly large number of people with different needs. It's about how bringing in more people with different needs allows us to imagine the world and imagine design in a very different and meaningful way that inevitably, we think, will push us toward creative and challenging and innovative solutions going forward.
Brilliant. Could you describe some specifics in the installation so that our listeners can kind of get more of an idea of the kind of nitty-gritty things that they can interact with there?
So like the play, the kind of the main play component is a web app called PlayPlay, and it is essentially a database of games that have multiple different kinds of filters on them that a facilitator can use to change those rules, change those games, as you know, what Josh was talking about earlier on, so that if a group of people are playing a game and then somebody's legs start hurting, for example, they don't want to play anymore using their legs, they can change the play style to games that have that don't use your legs and, you know, require everyone to sit down or to kind of, you know, shout things instead. Or equally, if somebody shows up in a wheelchair and can't run, those games would also be applicable to that situation. So it's just a set of games that can be changed to adapt to different play groups.
We have tried to use five general areas or thematics of inclusive design that we see many designers exploring currently. So we have play. That's obviously the one that Qing just mentioned, and it's kind of centered around that field itself and very literally is a space for play. We hope that people will be playing pretty much throughout this exhibition. There's an area on the emotions, there's one on the senses, there's one on care, and there's one on the social. These are really important areas where we see enormously innovative work being done by designers of very different ages and very different career stages, and each one has an anchor experience. So for example, in emotions, we've created a little digital demon, kind of a little monster that can appear on devices, also can sit on your shoulder in the form of an Instagram filter that people can take home. And it allows us to pick out emotions and the demon kind of exaggerates, kind of caricatures those emotions for us. And for many people who identify as neurodivergent, who may have issues with alexithymia, meaning being able to identify normative emotions, this helps a lot to model those emotions and maybe help to express it to other people if we have difficulty showing those emotions or knowing how to do that. So it's a little digital sprite that they can play with and they can also take home.
Fascinating. I wonder, I know you both met at Harvard, and I'm very interested in the fact that you're multidisciplinary, but you're obviously not just about creating buildings or housing people in structures. You're looking at all these diverse challenges that humankind kind of faces. When you came together and you decided to form your practice in 2015, was that what you always sort of set out? You're like, we are not just about creating a building. Who wants to take that one?
I love that question. We actually both studied architecture and landscape architecture at the GSD. So we both, I think, while in school already realized that there's not just one way to kind of go about tackling the issues that we were interested in. You know, we wanted to basically design together. And so we just said yes to everything that came our way, you know, different kinds of problems, completely different disciplines. We did some graphic work. We did all kinds of stuff. We just basically said yes to everything. And I think those early years were super formative in teaching us that actually architecture is not the only, it's not the only way to get at what we wanted to do, you know, and we've carried that all the way through.
Do you think also that certainly the pandemic reframed so many things from sort of human rights to just the way we're viewing the world? And I just, there's a lot of practices, like there's Assemble Architects in the UK. There's a lot of practices now in architecture that are just moving away from the sort of Starkitect view of more as a social practice. And do you see that shift generally?
We do see that. We see that a lot. And I think the pandemic really exaggerated that. And I think our pre-existing kind of common interest, if there was a single kind of thread that tied together what Qing was interested in, what I was interested in, even before we applied to graduate school in architecture, was the question of the social. It was not so much the idea that a building or a space or a design product is itself the outcome of the design process. It's what does that enable as a social outcome? What do different buildings allow us to do differently? What kind of interactions can we have one way or another based on the way that our surroundings, space, place, and landscape speak to us? So we were very interested in that. And especially across the pandemic, there was the sense of a crisis of the social, right? Like everybody else. I mean, we had each other and that was wonderful, but it was very often the sense of profound isolation and also a sense that some of the kind of social glue, that intense sense of, you know, reciprocity and relationality and entanglement we have with others was maybe under stress. It was under strain or maybe slipping a little bit. And that was a moment where we really felt that understanding of architecture as kind of the making the social, and in a much broader sense of design of making the social and imagining social worlds, was very important to us. And it was something that we really wanted to be able to explore more and also articulate more.
So getting together the various projects that we wanted to showcase, basically describing these amazing different approaches to designing inclusively across many different disciplines, it was a great chance for us to reach out to kindred spirits that were practicing, you know, all over the place.
So do you think it's actually cross-generational, this curiosity and this urge to be inclusive?
It is. I mean, from just looking at the diversity of ages, you know, of the designers that we're showcasing, it seems like certainly an issue that many people are thinking about, and not even just today. I mean, there are some projects that we're showing that have been around for years. What is interesting is just that, you know, sometimes it's the part, like, for example, OMA's Maison at Bordeaux, right? Which is which is obviously an inclusive project, it wasn't really discussed in that way, right? It's not framed. It's never kind of been put in an inclusive show. But we're putting it in the show with other people who have also thought about different forms of accessibility and different forms of kind of inclusion that maybe were not part of that conversation back then. But now framing it in this way, I think obviously sparks another kind of community of practitioners and conversations around that. So the ages are varied for sure, but I think having a show kind of this scale about inclusion is definitely something of today, right? So it's amazing that Design Singapore prompted this topic.
I think now's a good time to talk about your Hack Care project, which is absolutely fascinating, which is this brilliant IKEA-style catalogue, which is sort of an open source thing, really, right? It was to help people. It's kind of 50 DIY ways to change furniture to better suit people living with dementia syndrome. And this very much taps into something we're talking about, which is called flexibilities and kind of designing in ways that make things flexible for people. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about that. And I know it came about because of personal reasons for you, Xing, helping your father. That was quite a long project. And it's not a built building, it's a book. But can you tell me about what some of the challenges are in a house when somebody is living with dementia syndrome and how that hack booklet kind of helped that? Xing.
Thanks for bringing up Hack Care. I think, you know, we think of our homes as reflections of ourselves, right, and of our lives. But we very rarely are able to adapt them when there is a kind of serious medical issue. I think we tend to turn to buying appliances and equipment that are clearly medical, you know, like a hospital bed, right?
Yeah, or like hoists.
Yeah, or like hoists, or like, you know, those kind of commodes that are made to get completely wet in the bathroom. We tend to kind of go there straight away and not really understand our houses as being able to kind of adapt to us and our changing needs almost on a kind of day-to-day basis. And the problem with dementia is that it's not like, you know, you have an accident, you hurt your leg, and then all of a sudden you can't walk. And there's a certain predictability to that, like, you know, how many months before you recover, or will you always be in a wheelchair? And then, you know, in a way, it's kind of a static condition. The thing with dementia is unfortunately, it's always deteriorating. And the way that you deteriorate as a patient really depends on you and what you were like before, like how fit you were, the way that your brain used to operate, right? It's very much what they call dependent on the patient's pre-morbid personality, which means what they're like before they get diagnosed with the condition. So there has to be this ability to adapt the home, like almost on a bespoke way. So you can't just go out and buy appliances, right? I mean, it's really something that almost like the caregiver, the people who love that person have to help to adapt the house incrementally to suit them. So that way of thinking, I think it's quite a new way of thinking about this, about disease management at home. And so the book really tries to put that forward, that it's not by hacking. Hacking is really this incremental tweaking. And we really have to think about it in that way. And also to empower caregivers to understand that some of the things they do are already like this, right? Like if suddenly the person that you are looking after has difficulty eating out of a particular kind of spoon, you wouldn't think twice about going out to change the spoon, get a shallower one, get a smaller one, whatever. Like that is the same as changing the orientation of the chair or, you know, tweaking the room to suit that person, and then, you know, leading to things that might look more architectural, like interventions that might look more in the realm of an architect or in the realm of a furniture designer, but actually caregivers can do it. So this book was all about that. It was all about trying to help people adapt themselves for their loved ones who might have this illness.
And can you give me an example? I think there's a chair that many people have, and what you did to that chair to kind of make that easier for people living with dementia.
Yeah, there was this same chair that we encountered again and again and again in the process of research. And the process of research really spent a lot of time just going to homes where care was active and looking at how people were dealing with these challenges and which ones they were able to tackle and which ones they weren't. And we always saw this chair in the corner, this sort of classic IKEA kind of lounge chair that is actually one of their oldest production items. What was very interesting about it was that people told us, well, it's a great chair, but once people get into it, they can't get out. Right? We have a lot of muscle atrophy as we get older, particularly in our legs. And when we look at the way that older adults use chairs, very often they're using their arms to get themselves out. But there are chairs that are just too low that you can't get out of once you get into. And so our thinking was, how do we take this ubiquitous thing and maybe instead of replacing it with a kind of medical chair that might be fantastically expensive, hard to get, with a long lead time when one orders it, how can we just take things that also exist at IKEA and then adjust it, you know, change it so that the seat doesn't sit so low, it sits a little bit higher, and then we can use the legs of another stool to create armrests, which the chair doesn't come with, that allows them to use their upper body strength to get out of the chair. And then how could we think about building in other objects around the back of it and the side, things that we might use in a bathroom, for example, to hold toiletries, also could be used to hold things like tissues, wet wipes, all kinds of very, very common care items that tend to clutter up the house and create a kind of a stressful and abnormal environment. Like, how could we make that easier, bring everything closer by using the things that existed already? And in many ways, this came from a certain amount of our own input, and it also came from just looking at what carers were doing already. And one of the things we realized very early is that carers are hackers. They're always dealing with limited resources, not enough time, not enough money, not enough training, a constantly changing situation where there are constantly different challenges that they have to face. And the way they do it is through everyday forms of ingenuity, by cobbling things together. We really believe that that is a form of design intelligence. And design intelligence isn't the sole property of professional designers. We see people deploying that. And part of the goal of the book was to draw attention to that. Say, look at all of this creativity. What if we learn from that? What if we collect these resources together and we show them as examples so that other people say, hey, I can do that. I do that.
It seems very much at the heart of your practice, the kind of co-creation aspect and working with people and not kind of, as you say, thinking I'm a professional expert and I know everything. I wrote a piece about it for The Observer, and it was very much about, you know, how with the Museum of Childhood, they were kind of, they had groups with children to co-participate. So with every project, are you kind of looking for ways to do that?
That was wonderful. When we started to work on preschools, the timing was extraordinary. We had young children and we had a home, and we were just fascinated by how we create spaces in ways that enable and sustain those kinds of mischievous intelligences that we see in children. And there was one beautiful day where somebody gave us some incredible educational toy. It was some plastic injection molded thing that had one or two uses. It was very prescriptive because it was educational, and it came in a cardboard box. And our children took it out and they played with the toy for about a minute, and then they put it aside and then spent the next hour playing with the box. Like, the box was a car, it was a house, it was an animal, it was a monster, it was a friend, it was everything, because it had a certain level of abstraction, and that allowed them to project things into it. It just became a target for their own imagination. And by reimagining the box, they took ownership of it. It wasn't like something that somebody else gave them and told them how to use. It was their own toy that they had made. And we started to see that very often in the behavior of children. We then verified that just anecdotally with the teachers and the principals of the school that we were designing for, did a lot of observation inside that environment, and came to this conclusion that if we designed less, right, moved away from the plastic playhouse model where there's a plastic window box with plastic flowers and a plastic watering can. It just sounds like a Radiohead song. But what I mean is that we create things that have cues, but leave a lot of room for misuse. And in fact, we kind of set things up so that the children look at it and say, I'm not going to use it like that. I'm going to use it my own way. And we found that when they did that, they'll just do the way that they sat, the way they carried objects, the way they imagined what bookcases and shelving and benches and seats around them would be like, that this would provide a lot of agency for these children really to make their school their own place.
You've designed for preschool, you've designed for people living with dementia syndrome, you've designed hospices, I think, worked on hospice care and also private cemetery. That is like life, right? If you're designing a multi-generational household, and this is a rising thing, What do you think is important when you're designing for multi-generational living?
It's interesting you say this. I mean, my father was very kind of near the end of his dementia journey and we had young kids. I actually wrote an essay about how the end and the beginning of lives start to approximate each other. And it was a real kind of, it just hit me really hard when I looked at the things that surround us towards the end of life and the things that surround us at the beginning. And they're very, very similar. And, you know, I realized then that we have so much in common actually across this whole spectrum of life. And really we should think about what we have in common rather than what really differentiates us. So, you know, this multi-generational housing, I mean, it's great that you mentioned this because actually one of Josh's and my kind of big paper projects that we love very much that actually never got done is a multi-generational house and where we imagined ways in which people of different generations, brothers and sisters, whatever, they have their own kind of separate spaces to be on their own and do the things that they need to do. But then there is this big concentration in common of all the things that we could do together. I think focusing on that, the kind of community spaces and spaces where you might just kind of casually bump into each other is really key, right? So that we really emphasize the common experiences in life.
And I think this is really front of mind for us because we live in a multi-generational house. We have three generations, kind of a compound of two little, you know, houses across a yard. And it's constantly a space of mediation, right? Of the grandchildren bugging the grandparents and, you know, the rituals of kind of overlap and privacy and all the kind of, it's really all of the elements of the social world in a weird way are there like as in microcosm, you know, and that it's very interesting to see how that works. And what there's a beautiful kind of interplay, I think, between, I would say, what we might call anchor points, things like the dining room table, right? We eat together as multiple generations several times a week, and it's chaotic and it's wonderful and it's noisy and it's fractious and it's, you know, everything happens there, right? It's the space where everything is kind of comes together and is negotiated. And the way that kind of rituals exist around that table is a really beautiful thing. I think those are the ways in which we find the kind of the intersection in the generational Venn diagram. And that's where we start to see a lot of really interesting points, as Xing was mentioning, where what we want are things in common. The things we enjoy are things in common. And a lot of humor and kind of playfulness arises out of that shared experience, I think.
Good luck with Singapore Design Festival. I wish I could come. It sounds like a lot of fun, what you've created. So best of luck for that. And thank you for your time today. That's it for this episode. Thank you to all of our guests and thank you for tuning in. We hope you've enjoyed our week of design and you can find more information about the future of design and reports from trade shows around the globe on our interiors platform. If you want to find out how to subscribe, head over to wgsn.com to discover how you can get access to our service. You can subscribe to this podcast on all major podcast platforms and if you like what you've heard, why not leave us a rating and review? In our next episode, in early October, our creative director, Lisa White, will be in conversation with cli-fi writer Kim Stanley, and they'll be exploring how sci-fi fiction becomes future reality. If you're interested in hearing more from us, do check out Lives of Tomorrow, our other podcast hosted by our CEO, Carla Buzashi, and you can find that on all platforms. Thank you for listening.